adentro. So we have a very, very certain meaning today in the gift of a very, very wonderful Vaishnava. We have heard her about him a lot. We have heard him speak at our Lokina temple recently when he came along with his parents. Radhika Raman Prabhu, one of the wonderful luminaries of our Iskcon movement. As you can see, he's a very, very young person. Madhu, a friend of the guy in Sanyasi. But he has a great legacy behind him. He was raised in the most wonderful way by his deeply Krishna conscious parents, a sense of homeschooling. And that schooling was not based on a regular subject which we, you know, KG class and all that. But he was trained in the Srimad Bhagavatam from the very birth. The born devotee. The born devotee of the Lord. And he grew up in America. In this way, at the age of 17, he took a graduation. And what is most surprising for anyone who hears this is that to get a PhD degree, you get PhD at 40, 45, sometimes even 50, people are talking about PhD. It's not uncommon. But he has a very specific record behind him. He was a PhD in Oxford University at the age of 22 years. So, they call it like a prodigy, or a prodigy, that means you are beyond his age. And he is a Vaishnava scholar, he did his PhD in the study of Jiva Goswami Siddhanta philosophy. And he has written many books himself. There's a long introduction I had in front of me, which goes into 4 pages. I will not read out. Because what an introduction, I would say, is the beauty, the pleasure of hearing it. Because whatever the introduction says, it is far more manifest when a great soul speaks. So today, we are always a little late in our program, so we will cut it short here and we will express to you our great joy. And we give it a blessing upon all of us that you are here. And you are speaking to all of us if you are mature, very balanced in terms of realization, and therefore you have a very balanced subject to speak on. They ask what subject you should speak on, and then this subject was shown to me, I said this is the perfect subject. Because most of us the reaction that's all doing this. And we are struggling the business conscience of the professional life, family life, you know, what to do, when to do, how to do, you know. So from a person who has deep mental realization, you can hear the head, the heart, and the hand. How to balance what we think, what we feel, and what we do actually. That typical question comes in all S1 programs. How to balance, how to balance. Commonest question in my S1 program. So this is a common problem, it's a common dilemma. There will be common solution for all of us here today. So let us, in a very, very happy, joyous mood of heart, welcome Radhika Raman Prabhu, our dear friend, to Prabhupada's hospital by loudly chanting,
Viva! Viva! Viva!
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Swamiji, for your most kind introduction. It's actually a great blessing for me to be here at Bhaktivedanta Hospital. It's something that I have heard of for so many years. A place which is so much appreciated by devotees, not just here, not just in India, but all over the world actually. And even devotees who have never had the fortune of taking advantage of its facilities, even they are so much appreciated that such a place exists. And it's my good fortune that today I have the opportunity finally to be here with you. And I'm sorry for the extra weight that you had to do. We had already 4 programs today, and they're all back to back to back from different places in town, so we just been running. But now I feel relaxed. I feel like I'm home in the company of family. So thank you all for having me here. Just before I start, how much time do we have? 1 hour. That's no problem. Yeah, yeah, no problem. Whatever is convenient and suitable. Om Jnana Sikaram Kutya Jnanam Jirakadaraya Jatakunomi Nidam Yena Tarasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manohisham Bhagavatam Yena Sutare Svayam Gurupa Kadavayam Tadati Svapadanatikam Vantayam Pati Yudhavayam Kutukasim Lukyayeva Chatpatihanam Bhagavayam Yodhavayam. So Albert Einstein, the famous physicist, he said that life is like riding a bicycle. In order to keep balance, you have to keep moving. And we live in a world, of course, which is a place of constant movement these days. Society is becoming more and more mobile. Employers expect their employees to be able to shift at a moment's notice, depending on what's necessary for the job. Children, as they grow older, they have to seek their careers in places that may be far away from home. And during the course of work also, we end up traveling so much. People end up traveling here and there and so forth. And pulled in all kinds of different directions. So there's no shortage of movement. And along with that movement, the pace of the movement is also increasing at higher and higher speed. People's schedules are more and more packed. We've got more and more things to do, to accomplish. Despite all the increase in technology that we have, with the advent of the washing machine and the microwave and the toaster and all these different types of household items, the idea was that this would make life easier, more comfortable, give us more time to do the things we really want to do. But they've done studies of households in the United States, in which they found that the amount of leisure time that people have over the last 50 years has gone down by a significant percentage, as the amount of so-called work-saving technology has increased. The amount of time we have extra left over after our work and so forth keeps going down and down and down. So somehow things are not getting easier. Things are not getting easier. And of course, we know that this is no surprise. This is the marker of this age. It's meant to be like this. And the pace of hectic life only increases over time. It doesn't decrease. And as a result, there are so many consequences that society in general suffers. Just recently, I was reading an article in which it says they had some statistics from the National Institute of Mental Health in the United States, which kind of keeps track of mental health in the country. And it says that one in four adult Americans have a diagnosable mental disorder. One in four have a diagnosable mental disorder. And something like maybe 65-70% of all Americans say that at some point in life they will seek professional help for the amount of stress in their life. The majority of the stress is, of course, work that is related, but many other reasons as well. And the fastest growing market for antidepressant pills among the population, those who are taking these pills, is now preschool age children, those who are 5 and under. And there's over 1 million preschool children who are clinically depressed in the United States. Childhood is always regarded as a time of happiness and carefree life and freedom and so forth. But even the very youngest amongst us are not free from the impact of Kaliyuga. And so the question of trying to find the balance, the question of trying to smooth out what's pulling us in different directions, it becomes ever the more crucial. It becomes extremely important, very practically necessary in today's world. And in fact, although the pace of life that we experience today may be unprecedented, the question of finding the right balance is not a new question at all. People, thinkers, philosophers around the world, from the beginning of human civilization, have asked the question, have wondered, what is the way to find a balance between the different aspects of human existence, which we can characterize as the head, the heart, and the hand. Or the reason, the reasoning abilities, the emotions, and our actions. How to find this right balance. For example, the ancient Greek philosophers like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle, they argued that the most important aspect of human being is reason. This is the intellectual capability that we have higher than animals. Animals also have emotions, they do actions, but it's reason which is most important. And this is why reason should be privileged amongst the three, and the others, they should be held in control using the intellect. In Christianity, the Christian theologians, they also struggle with the same problem. And they often put it in terms of the balance between faith and work. What is it that's more important for God? Do you achieve God by faith, by shraddha, or is it by work, by the work you do for Him? The dharma, or the service, or the seva, what is it? And generally, Christian theologians, they resolve the question in favor of faith. That it is through faith alone and not through work that one achieves God. So like this, people have struggled with the question over time. And in the Vedic tradition also, in our own history, this question has presented itself in its own way. And this is trying to find the balance between karma, jnana, and bhakti. Between those aspects which involve the physical body, those that involve the intellect, and those that involve the heart. All three. For example, in ancient Vedic times, the karma mimamsaka, they argued that they were scholars of the Veda, and they said that what the Veda says about who we are, what the world is like, that's not important. The only thing that's important is what the Veda tells us to do. If the Veda says, do this sacrifice, do this yajna, then we have to do it. What it says about the world, that's not so important. But the Upanishads, they say, the Vedantic thinkers, no, that's not right. More important than the karma you perform is your perspective on the world, the knowledge you have, jnana. Because it's jnana which will lead us to liberation. So we have to begin by asking the question, who am I? What's the purpose of life? Why am I here? Atato brahmati jnana. This is the beginning, right now, in the human form of life, atha. Therefore, atha, brahmati jnana. Let us inquire into Brahma. And this jnana, this knowledge, is what will actually free us, actually liberate. Philosophers like Shankaracharya took this to the extreme. They argued about the importance of jnana as the source of all this knowledge. Whereas other Vaishnava philosophers, thinkers, emphasized the process of bhakti. And they said, yes, what you know is important, but what you know is not sufficient to get you liberation. If you know God, that's very good. But that knowledge in itself is not enough. One has to cultivate a relationship, a sambandha has to be there. And that relationship has to be expressed through bhakti or devotion. And bhakti, of course, is not just a state of mind, but actually physical service. It's activity. And in this way, the circle comes full round. That incorporating the idea of karma or action as well. So these types of debates have gone on through history for a long time. But everyone agrees that all three are necessary. You won't find anyone saying that just one and the others are all equal. At best, they'll say one includes the other, but they won't reject the importance of the other, because after all three are important, right? We all know. Without the head, without the heart, without the hand, how can you have a balanced human life? All three are crucial, and they all work together. The question is just how to find the right balance. Now, these three things often come in a developmental fashion. There's a hierarchy involved also. We learn from Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna, he lists all the different types of yogis that are there. All the different types of spiritualists, tapasvi, yamis, and so forth. And he says, tapasvibhya go yogi. That even greater than the tapasvi is the yogi. Greater than the jnani is the yogi. Greater than the karmi is the yogi. And then in the next verse he says, yoginama vitarvesha matkate nantarasana shatraman vide yoga same yukta. That of all these yogis, the greatest is one who is united to me with God in faith, in faith. So, I can give you an example. Two people may be working together as colleagues. Like this happens in the material world very often. Two people working together as colleagues, one's a man, the other's a woman. And as they are working well together, they're working on the same project, and as a result of their cooperative work together as being colleagues, over long hours together, they get to know about each other in great detail. They learn you like this, I like this, he works like this, she works like this. These are his strengths, these are her strengths, these are his weaknesses. And like that, they get to know everything about each other. This knowledge, over time, it can lead to some affection. And pretty soon, the two are involved in some way. That knowledge leads to some kind of attachment, and they fall in love, and they end up getting married. Now, this is a trajectory. Here it won't happen so much. But this is, in the United States, Western countries, very, very common. But the point being that action leads often to knowledge. Knowledge can lead to relationship. And then, when the relationship or the devotion is there, then it feeds the other way around. It goes in the opposite direction. Because one who loves someone, there is no better way to know a person than to love them. In other words, once the relationship is made, they're husband and wife, then who knows more about the husband than the wife? Who understands the wife better than the husband? And practically everything about them, they understand. And so that then the knowledge itself becomes intensified. It becomes deeper. This is why Krishna says, bhaktya maam abhijanati yavan yashchasmi tat svaha. That through bhakti alone you can know me as I am, yashchasmi tat svaha, in truth. Just like the President of the United States, Barack Obama, he's made so many headlines because of what he's done. He's accomplished his feat of being the first African American to take office in this country. And he says, you know, so many people are working with him at a very close up, his advisors and so forth. But who can know him better than his close family? His daughter's name was Sasha and Maria. And they know their father. They may not know anything about the work he does. They may know very little. But they know him in a way that is very deep. That is closer than what anyone else knows. Why? Because their knowledge is based on devotion. It's based on affection, on love. It's founded on relationship. And therefore, it leads to greater and greater knowledge. And that knowledge, of course, leads to so many loving exchanges, so many activities that they do together. Because the product of that is action. It will be service as well. So you can see these three things are so closely tied together in our life, in our existence. But sometimes what happens is, in the course of our life, we find ourselves pulled in various directions. And some of these things, they go up and down. Just like sometimes if you're doing some kind of physical labor and you use one set of muscles too much, then those muscles, they become tense and they pull the bones out of place. And you're out of alignment. And so you have to go to someone to see, okay, push this person back into alignment, and then the pain is relieved. So this way we're pushed, we're pulled in various kinds of directions. And one of these three features, they can go out of alignment. And this can be the cause of so much stress or mental disorder and so forth. That stress or that problem can show up at any one of these three levels. Take for example, sometimes we feel completely stressed out because we have so much to do. We're overworked. And so we say, things are getting out of hand. I can't handle this anymore. And we become very tense as a result. Or it is maybe about the plan, the thinking that itself is causing the stress. The plans that we make. Let me show you one slide here. So look at these three, the hand, the head, and the heart. The head is concerned with the question, what do I need to do? What are the things I need to do? The heart asks, why do I need to do it? What's the purpose behind it? What's the motivation? And the hands ask, how do I do it? These three questions are fundamental to human existence. Why, what, and how. And each one has a role to play. Another way of looking at the same thing. The heart is concerned with motivation. The head with method. And the hand with mechanics. Motivation, method, and mechanics. Yet another way of thinking about the same thing. The head moves towards synthesis, bringing things together, seeing commonality between people, seeing unity amongst people. The head moves towards analysis, towards viveka, towards discrimination. Okay, this is like this, this is like this, you're like this, you're like this, and so forth. And analyzing a problem, a situation, cutting it into little pieces. And so the hands, they move towards practice. Synthesis, analysis, and practice. Yet another way of thinking about it, the heart is concerned with intuition, the head with reason, and the hand with action. And finally, the heart, it reaches up. It looks towards things that are greater than who we are, our aspirations, our goals, where are we trying to go. The head is reaching inward, trying to understand things, analyzing. And the hand is reaching out, reaching up, reaching in, and reaching out. And finally, to put it in more Vedic terms, this is the relationship between bhakti, jnana, and karma. So sometimes, the cause of stress can be because we're operating at one level and we need to move it up to the next level. Suppose, as I was saying, that we're very overworked. We've got too much to do. This can be a cause of intense stress for us, when we've got too much on our plate. So anyone will tell you that it's very useful in a situation like that to organize yourself. Move it from the level of the hand to the level of the head. And say, okay, why don't I sit down and make a list of all of the things I need to do? Once I've made a list, let's prioritize that list. What are the things that I need to do immediately to get that in the near future? Once I do that, let's make a time schedule and try for some time management. And put the things in the right slot. And now, you've got a plan. Okay. Immediately you feel some relief. Things are not out of hand, I can handle this. I've got a plan. I've made a list, I've made an organized schedule. So moving things from the hand to the level of the head, it can help relieve stress. It can help relieve problems. But then, sometimes, it is the head itself which is causing all the stress. Sometimes, it's all the plans that we have which is the problem. We've got any number of plans, all lined up. We've got to do this, we've got to do this, we've got to do this, and to accomplish this, to accomplish that, to accomplish this. Okay. We've got so many plans and so many ambitions. And perhaps it's the ambitions that are causing so much stress. I want to be here by this time. I want to do this. I want to accomplish that. I want to become the best reputed person in my field, whatever it might be. Or maybe, instead of ambition, we feel a sense of inadequacy. That everyone around me, they're doing so well, and I'm the only one who's not doing well. Everyone seems to understand. I don't get it. Everyone seems to be moving from one success to another, and I'm no good. Perhaps it's a sense of inadequacy, or it's a sense of ambition, or it's because we've got too many plans and life is too well organized. This too can be a cause of stress. In that case, we have to move it up to the next level and ask ourselves, why? Why am I doing this? What's the purpose of all of this? What's the goal behind it? What do I really want from life? Because very often we'll find that the things that cause us the most stress are often the things that actually matter to us the least in the long term. Because we spend our life fighting with the little things in life as we move towards the grander things. I forget who said that. But the little things, this is a nice experiment actually, sometimes. If you take a piece of paper and you make a list of the top five priorities you have in life, things that matter to you the most, that you really value, whether it's your consciousness, your family, or maybe many things might show up, the top five things that matter. And then you make another list of the top five things that you end up spending your time in, most of your time engaging. Many people will find that these two lists are upside down. They're opposite to each other. That the things we end up spending the most time in are actually things that we are the least concerned about in the long term. And things that matter to us the most, we don't have time for. Because of the nature of the world, the way we're driven. So we think, okay, Krishna consciousness has to be a priority in my life. But you know, at the moment I'm going through a really difficult time. I've got a lot of things to accomplish. So once this is over, I'll take it seriously. I'll take care of it. I remember when I was just starting university as an undergraduate student doing my MBA. It was a completely new experience. I was quite young at the time and so forth. And things were so busy, so hectic, with all these assignments and these trying to see the professor and getting things done in time for them. And I used to think, well, you know, this is a time of training for me, of preparation for life. So let me focus on this. As soon as I'm done with my BA, then I'll really take my switch life seriously. Then I'll take out time to make sure that, you know, I really do my rounds nicely, and I do a lot of reading, and I focus on Krishna consciousness. Once the BA is finished, it's just a matter of a few years. Unfortunately, the BA came, and before it was over, of course, I was applying for postgraduate studies, for master's. Now, BA is not enough. I have to get a master's in my course. And I thought that BA was a lot of work. But naturally, then you go on to the next level, it's even more work. There's even more pressure. More assignments, more things you have to do, more deadlines you have to meet, more things you have to juggle. But master's is only a year, 2 years or more. So I get through this, and then I can focus on Krishna consciousness. I can really, things that really matter. But after master's, of course, then there is a PhD. I have to get the PhD. And
oh boy, PhD, how am I supposed to? Now you have an advisor, a supervisor, a team. Then on top of that, you have to come up with some original research, some original ideas, your own theory, your own method of finding the results. And it's a constant 24/7 type engagement. The pressure keeps increasing and building. And then genuinely thought, okay, after I finish my PhD, then that's it. Like it has to be. What's there after PhD? Nothing else. It's the highest degree that's possible. So after PhD, now then everything. Now we can focus on Krishna consciousness. Things that really matter to us. But of course, the PhD is not over, and then I have to find a job. Because, you know, not having a job as a BA has, that's one thing. But unemployed PhD looks even worse. It's really bad. He's been out of PhD for 6 years and still doesn't have a job. How terrible. So no, the amount of pressure is even greater. Has to get a good position. So you work to get a position. But for any type of job, any type of career you pursue, you always begin where? At the bottom. Always you begin at the bottom. So then assistant professor. One day, associate professor. Then full professor. And then at some point, if this is about halfway to my PhD, I realized I cannot live life preparing to live. I cannot live life in preparation for that day when everything is nice and I can serve Krishna. Everything is nice and now I can focus on things that matter to me. That day will never arrive. This is life. Right? If you think things are bad now, they'll only get worse over time. Everyone said, no, wait till you get a job, you'll see what life is really like. Then they said, wait till you get married, you'll see what life is really like. Now I'm married, they say, wait till you have children, then you'll see what life is really like. And of course, it'll just get more and more and more and more intense. So this is the nature of the material world. And the material world works like a whirlpool. Maya keeps sucks us in. Deeper and deeper and deeper. And the more we struggle, the more we go in deeper, faster. And this is why Prahlada Maharaj says, the time to focus on the things that matter to us, that time is now. He says, Bomaram Achare Sadhu. This has to begin right from the beginning. He says, Bomaram, right from childhood. But the point is, wherever we might be, it has to begin now. Because this is life. This is what we've been given. And if we can't do it now, we won't be able to do it later. And if we can't do it later, then there's no way we can do it in the time step. Because no matter how intense a situation might be while we're alive, nothing compares to the situation at the second step. At that point, it's like all systems are shutting down. Everything is shutting down. Everything we know, everything we can hold on to, is leading us. At that time, it's the most intense. So the practice, the balance, the rearrangement of priorities. We live in a society that is so product or result-oriented. Everything is a matter of productivity. What are the results you have to show? Everything has to be quantifiable these days. And this whole environment, it basically what it does is it makes us focus more and more and more on the level of the hand, the level of the head. What are you producing as a result? If a student spends 1 hour, what did you get from it? What did you accomplish? If the person at work spends an hour working on a project, then what are the results from it? So much so that if there's something that doesn't have tangible results, spend an hour doing theatre, what did you get? What's the result? What do you have to show for? Then things like that, they lose that. They lose that. In today's environment, you look at students all over the world, they don't have time for activities. Forget virtual activities. Even for activities that develop the other side of their existence. The creative side, the imaginative side,
doing music and doing art and doing things that they can pursue with a passion, even that is not there. What do you think of spiritual life? Because everything is result, everything is what they experience. That is good, that's necessary. But we can't be happy like that. We can't strive for that balance and that thing. It will manifest itself in the form of stress, in the form of anxiety, in the form of depression, and so forth. Because we're not feeding a very important part of our existence. We're not actually feeding the soul. One of the wonderful things about a place like this is that you strive for this kind of a balance approach. You strive for the patients, for the people, to have both a healthy body, a healthy mind, and ultimately a healthy soul. To have that full-rounded environment. There's a story once of three people who were laying brick. They were bricklayers. And they were all working on the same job. They would put the mortar, lay the brick. Put the mortar, lay the brick. A very heavy, menial, very hard-working job. And a very monotonous one, also. All day in front of laying brick. So one time he went to these three bricklayers. And he said, he asked the first one. He said, excuse me, sir, what are you doing? And the man looked at him like, what do you think I'm doing? Can you not sit and lay in brick? Is your head as thick as a brick? This is how we go. One, two, like, I have to do this. I've been doing this for 6 hours. I've got another 3 hours to go. And I just can't wait to get up. Okay, thank you, sir. He went to the next person and said, sir, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm working on a job. This is my job, and I earn a living. And in this way, I make money, and I want to provide a comfortable life for myself and for my family. One day, I hope I can save enough, I can move on to a different career. I'd like to get myself paid as well. Okay, thank you, sir. He goes to the third person, and he says, sir, what are you doing? I'm laying bricks to build a beautiful temple for the Lord. This temple will rise high into the sky, and one day my children, they will come to worship here. And my grandchildren as well. And I'll be able to bring them here and show them what I have done, what small role I have played in my service. Now, you see, all three persons are doing exactly the same activity. Exactly the same thing. But each one is working at a different level. Each one is operating at a different level. The process of devotional service, the process of Krishna consciousness, is not so much the process of changing what we do, or how we do it, but changing why we do it. What the purpose is behind. Because the how and the what will be there. We have to do what we have to do. We have to do it how we have to do it. The methodology is there. The process is there. In any kind of job or any kind of professional, but we have to do what we have to do. There's not a whole lot of flexibility there. Just because we're devoted. But it's not about how or what we do, but why we do it. That's the crux of Krishna consciousness. This is why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yet karoshi, yet ashanti, yet jubhoti vilasya, yet tapasati konde, tat purushma madarsana. That whatever you do, whatever you offer, whatever you give away, whatever austerities you perform, sacrifices you do that, O Sanatasi, as an offering to me. Do that for my sake. Mama Lutmana Yudhisthira. You have to fight. You have to remain focused. But do it instead for me. Do it for my sake. So sometimes in terms of stress, like it can be caused, okay, we're feeling stress at one level, it can be useful to move it up to the next level. And ask ourselves, especially as devotees, to ask ourselves the question, when something like that strikes, why am I doing this in the end? What's the purpose of it? I know, in my own experience, working in the academic field, we have our own types of pressure, our own types of intensity that run importance of religious studies. And once a year, all the religious studies professors, all the religious professors in America, they gather for their annual professional conference called the American Academy of Religious Conference. And it's quite an amazing thing. Over 8,000 professors of religion from all over the country show up in one place, you can imagine. The whole city is overrun with religious professors. And people who talk a lot about God, but rarely believe in it. That's the situation most of the time. Anyway, they all come together. It's a professional conference. So people are presenting papers, and they're writing books, and there's a job market there where there's interviews going on for different positions across the country. And such a hectic situation. When you go there, you meet people who know so much more than you do, who publish more than you have, who have a better reputation than you have, that are more accomplished in every way, that have better positions at better universities, and over time, in a very subtle way, the pressure starts building. People will give you advice. You should be doing this. Why don't you do this? Why don't you write that paper? Why don't you? And you think, I should have prepared that book. I didn't know the answer to that question. I should have been doing like this. I should be there. And all these ambitions and these goals and this sense of inadequacy and all these things, they start piling up over time. And the mind starts going in overdrive mode, hyperdrive, becomes more and more intense. And so many times it's just useful to take a moment out into a corner. Sit down, even if you don't have a quiet corner, sit even in the place you're sitting, and just ask yourself, okay, hold on, what am I doing? What's the point? What's the purpose? Why am I here? What do I actually want to accomplish as a result? Who am I? Like, that's a basic question. Who am I? And you ask yourself this evening, okay, I'm a devotee of Krishna. I'm a servant of Krishna. The only reason I went into this field was that I could do something for the Lord. This person may be so much more accomplished in every way. He may have more papers than I do. But I spend over 3 hours every day doing sadhana. I spend 2 hours chanting my rounds. I spend half an hour chanting three gayatris. I spend as much time as possible, preferably at least an hour a day, reading Prabhupada's book. Right? That's a choice I made. We have to remind ourselves at that point that at some point in life we sat down and we made a choice that this is the path I want to choose. This is the life I want to lead. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves of why we made that choice. Because over time we can forget. As human beings, we have a forgetful nature. And we can get so caught up in the materialistic environment, in the pressure of our fears, that we forget. Why did I make this choice? Do I want to be where this person is at the sacrifice of my spiritual life? Or the sacrifice of the time I have to devote to family? Or to sacrifice the time I have to preach Krishna consciousness? And of course the answer is immediately, no. No. I cannot give up that life. I know I made this choice for very good reasons. We all made this choice for very good reasons. We have our own reasons. We should sit down and every day think about, why did I make this choice? This sacrifice to the Lord. And you remember that? Immediately. I don't have to be who they are. I don't have to do what they are doing. Because my heart is in a different place. I've given my heart to someone else. I've made a commitment elsewhere else. And every commitment comes with a certain level of sacrifice, with a certain level of responsibility. So that's the perspective of Krishna consciousness. Is constantly reminding ourselves of this point, of this priority. Where am I trying to head? How do I get there? But ultimately, why am I doing this? And moving it up in that way. If we have this ability to separate ourselves from whatever situation we are in and think, I'm not this body, but I'm also not the mind. I'm also not the intelligence. And if we can pull ourselves apart and watch ourselves go through these, oh, look at my mind, it's going through this stress. Look at this problem. And if we can do that, separate ourselves, distance ourselves from the situation, that itself leads out the problem. So, in situations of stress, it's often useful to move it upward. Move it up the ladder. Gotta go into jnana. If it's something, if it's a decision that we have to make, imagine the important decisions in life, it's often useful to move down the ladder. We have an important decision coming up. What career should I pursue? Should I take this step in my career? Who should I marry? Any kind of decision we might have. First, we can ask the question, okay, what's the purpose? What's the priority? Why am I doing this? Where do I want to be 20, 30, 40 years down the road? In the long term. What do I want to see at the end of my life from my deathbed? Then we think, okay, this is my goal, this is my purpose. Now, what do I need to do to accomplish it? Then we make a plan from that. And this will also may require some adjustment. Just because something is there in our heart may not mean that it's practical. Right? When the mind gets involved, then we may have to make some adjustments. The heart says, oh, I want to get married. Okay. I want someone like this, like this, like this, like this, like this. Then you come to the level of the mind and tell them, look, there's no girls like that. Yeah? You're not going to find anyone like that. You won't find a husband who's got all those qualities. Okay. Now, adjustment necessary. Maybe I should calm things down a little bit. Shorten my expectations. Okay. Then, the level of the heart. Finally, after we've decided what we need to do, now we make a plan of action. How do I do? What are the actual steps I need to take and how can I take them to actually manage them? So often in life, we go through doing things without putting these priorities in place, without going through this process. We just do things, why? Because everyone else is doing it. And so therefore we have to. In other words, we enter at the level of the hand. Sabno kare chalo, he says. Or the level of the mind. Everyone is thinking like this, I should think like this. Without actually asking this question of bhakti, asking this question of motivation. The vast majority of people in this world, they go through life like sheep. You know, just one following the other, one behind the other. If you ask the average person on the street, suppose you're at a university campus. This is where most of the time I'm spending my time as a teacher, professor. And you talk to the average student, and you stop and say, excuse me, why are you working so hard? Why are you studying so hard? And the first reaction you're going to get is he's going to look at you like your face. He's going to roll his eyes. Working so hard, who's here is not working hard? You're not working hard? No, just why are you working hard? Then, well, I need to get good marks on my papers and my examination. So you say, okay, why do you need good marks on your papers and examination? Because if I get good marks, then when I graduate, I can get a good job. Obviously. Okay, why do you want a good job? Because I want a comfortable life. I want everything I need to live comfortably. Of course, you can survive on just about anything, but I don't just want to survive. I want to have what I want. I want to be comfortable. I want to make sure my family is
observe why do you want that comfort? Why do you want all those things in life? And if he's still with you, he's still willing to humor you and answer your questions. He'll probably scratch his head for a while and say, well, I want to be happy. I want to be happy. And then the final question you ask is, well, between these two things, do you know, is there any equation that material things, material goods, having what you want, having the money you need, that this will lead to happiness? Do you know this for a fact? And if he's honest, he'll say, no. You look anywhere around you, you look in the world. Sometimes it looks like some people have it all. They've got everything. They've got the good looks, they've got the good job, they've got the perfect family, they've got all the comforts they need, they've got all the fame in the world. But it's never like that. Right? All you have to do is scratch under the surface a little bit. And pretty soon you realize that their plate of problems is as full as yours. Perhaps even worse. We see so many examples of this. All kinds of people that are being convinced of failure. Everyone knows, though, this equation is not true. It doesn't work. Then, sir, why are you working so hard? Why are you going so hard if that equation is not true? And the only reason is because this is what everyone is doing. This is what everyone told me to do. This is what the world is doing. So I have to do it too. And no one stops. No one stops to think, what is the purpose of it all? Why did I embark on this journey in this world? What do I want to get as an impulse? No one stops. And so, basically, you have people who are operating at these levels in a very, very one-sided and lopsided way. And so it manifests in all these different issues and problems. But the whole process of Krishna consciousness is a process of finding the right balance. Of bringing these three things together and saying, look, I'm going to put my priorities in place. I'm going to decide what is important. And I'm going to make time for it. I'm going to make room for it. Because in the end, ultimately, that is what matters. And sometimes, when we're not able to accomplish this balance, Krishna is so kind that he'll force us to do it. He'll give us something in life that will just stop us in its tracks. Sometimes this is some kind of a serious health problem. We'll go through some experience that just forces us to reconsider what our priorities are. Oh my God. Sometimes we might be able to observe someone else's experience very closely, very personally. I remember just a few weeks ago when I was going to Radadesh in Belgium, in Europe, to teach. On the way back home from there, I was going to an airport just waiting for a flight. I was on the phone making a phone call home. And just behind me, I heard sounds of moaning and people shouting. And a lady I had been just sitting next to, a few feet down, she just collapsed.
Yep.
She had a heart attack. And she was not, she didn't recognize the symptoms, she didn't call for help. People thought she was just having a very bad day, she was just very down or depressed or whatever. And finally, by the time they discovered her glasses were on the floor, she had doubled over and she had collapsed. And the paramedics, the ambulance, they arrived at the airport, they were there, right there. Within 2 minutes they came with this machine, what's it called? Right now they have this in airports in the U.S. everywhere. Every section of the building has one of these for situations like this. And immediately someone arrived and they came and they started doing chest compressions and they put this on and they tried for an hour. They tried and they kept trying and they wheeled away and they took it away. You should have seen the atmosphere that came over all the passengers waiting there.
the whole gate area. Everyone felt tired, like the Prophet said, like birds at the end of the day. Just like someone had turned everything off. He came completely tired. Everyone's looking at each other, not knowing what to say. A couple of people were saying, who were sitting next door, were starting to feel very guilty. Maybe had I noticed this before, I would have talked to them before. And then it was very interesting to notice the difference in the attitude of the people waiting and those passengers who were just arriving from the gate area to meet their flight. And they were all chirping and talking and laughing and joking and eating and this and that, and life was all happy and normal. And the other passengers in the meantime, there was this gloom that had descended on top of them. But of course we know that even though Krishna had given them that kind of situation, it won't last very long. Yudhishthira makes the point very clear. He says, Aham yahani bhutani gacchanti na yamanaye shesha bhavara gacchanti kim aashchati mahampara. That every living entity is here. Aham yahani bhutani. Day after day, gacchanti ha yamanaya. They're all going to Yamaloka. They're all dying. One after another. Every day we see here, of course, in the United States, everything is very covered. So it's all the more shocking experience for people. Because you don't see dead bodies. Very few of them. It's hard to even see a seriously sick person. Everything is covered. So you don't have to be, you don't have to suffer through this kind of realization about the nature of life. It can go along in many ways. But when it does happen, people see it day after day. But Shesha, Sahara, Nishanti. The rest, they think, I can be fine. By the time everyone got on the plane, everything was back to normal. Like nothing had happened. And people were again on their mobile phones, and they were again complaining about how the plane is 15 minutes late, and this and that, and so forth, and people getting upset and angry and so forth. But from a devotee's perspective, these moments in life are often wake-up calls to Krishna. We will all have them. If we haven't had them yet, we will have them one day. These times when Krishna will put the reality in our face and he'll make us put things in balance if they're not there already. And this is his great mercy. This is his great mercy upon devotees, upon his own servants, that he puts us in situations like this where we have to come to face with the situation and put our priorities in order. Because he wants to remind us that today, if today was your last day, would you be ready? If today was your last day, one of the things that I admire most about my Guru Maharaj, Hanumat Veshaka Swami Maharaj, is that he lives his life in such a way that he's always ready. And he's always, every moment is the moment for him. Krishna consciousness has a sense of urgency for it. This is so often what happens in our practice of Krishna consciousness. We start off with a lot of enthusiasm. And that enthusiasm then gradually is leveled off. And then we get into this rut. Okay, I'm chanting my nouns, okay, I'm doing what I need to do, okay, I do my seva every Sunday and so forth. And things kind of level off. And we lose our sense of urgency. We become so big. That this is the most important thing. And I have to keep moving up forward. Initiation means exactly that. Initiate. It's just the beginning of the process. By Guru Maharaj, he says, there's first initiation, there's second initiation, there's third, there's fifth, there's seventh, there's 65th initiation. Every time the spiritual master helps you take your service to Krishna to a new level. This is initiation. He's guiding you on how to make your progress to Krishna consciousness better. When we go to the spiritual world, one of Krishna's assistant servants might teach us how to boil the milk properly for Krishna. So we get initiated. Yet again, maybe it's our 256th initiation. But Krishna consciousness is constantly a process of moving upwards, of maintaining that urgency. That yes, this moment made in my life, in my day. And you think, well, that's a very gloomy way to do it. That's a very depressed way to do it. Isn't that it? It's a depression. Thinking about death all the time. It's actually just the opposite. If we live life in the present, if we live life with this consciousness, not the consciousness of death, but the consciousness of Krishna, then every moment he comes to us. This is again what I noticed about him. He was, my Guru Maharaj was constantly focused that this may be my last moment. And because of this, he's constantly happy. Every moment is like a festival of joy. We can't wait for the day that Krishna says, okay, enough time in the world. Time to go back to God. To get off the train. Because who wants to ride on the train the whole time? You wait for the station where you can get off. So he's happy. He's very joyful. Okay, I'm going. This is my priority in life. This is my focus. So we should try to endeavor ourselves, this point of balance. And when Krishna gives us a gentle or not so gentle reminder, then we take that as Krishna's word. This is the devotee's quality. That, you know, some people, they see it, whatever happens to them, as their own accomplishment or their own fault. Or they blame God for it. Other people, they don't blame God. They just think, oh, it's my son. This is what I deserve. But the devotee, he doesn't even see it as his own karma. He sees everything as only Krishna Kripa, the mercy of Krishna. That's it. Prabhupada has a very nice passage in Krishna Bhagavad. Where he says, it's only the devotee has the perspective that everything is Krishna Kripa, the mercy of Krishna. Not even karma, because karma is very impersonalistic. No. Good or bad, it's the mercy. So this is what I have to offer. Thank you very much for your attention and for spending this night, even though I know we're a little late and we must all be tired. Do you have some time for questions? Okay. So if there's any questions, comments, discussions, ideas, please feel free. To figure out how things need to happen. I've had this experience on a number of occasions myself, that you're in a situation where, okay, it's a choice. You can drag around, or you can get something done, which is urgent. It's just waiting for you. It's just dying. There's someone who's been just like, or perhaps it's even a teaching engagement, or something like that. And if you choose the chanting, then Krishna arranges things in such a way that what you needed to do, it gets done. It happens. This is, of course, see, all this is a matter of faith, it's a matter of shraddha. The reason arranging our priorities are not so easy for us is because our shraddha is not fully developed. It takes time to develop. The process of developing faith, the firm conviction in Krishna, is not an easy thing, like you're saying. It's a difficult thing, it's a gradual process. Tiffany says Dhamma that says, Shraddha Shabde Vishwaspade Sudhir Nishchaya. That Shraddha means the firm conviction that if I serve Krishna, then Sarva Karma Sindhu, then everything else in life will be taken care of. And you can say, well, okay, that's nice in theory. How is this going to happen in practice? I sit and chant my rounds and Krishna will beat my head. So yes, the answer is of course yes. But we don't have that shraddha yet. Right? We're not at that level. So we have to be honest with ourselves also. Krishna fed Mrigali, the hunter. You know the story of Narada Muni Mrigali. And he broke his bone. And Krishna fed him and his family. And so yes, that's true. But okay, we need to come to that level of faith gradually. So how does it happen? We do it step by step, little by little. We make a little extra sacrifice to Krishna. Maybe go the extra mile, as they say. Do something that's just a little bit beyond what our capability is. What we're comfortable doing. We go out of our comfort zone, as they say, for Krishna. And we do that, and Krishna, he will reciprocate in such a wonderful way. Krishna, he will never penalize us for something we do extra. He'll never say, today you spend 15 minutes extra doing devotional service, now you'll see what will happen at work. Everything will go wrong. Everything will fail. He'll never do that. Because Krishna is so grateful for anything we do for him. He's so grateful that he'll take 10 steps towards us to make things okay. And when we just do a little bit extra, and when we see that, our faith increases. I made a little sacrifice for Krishna, beyond what was comfortable for me. And Krishna, he took care of me. Next time, we make a little bit more sacrifice. Let me try doing a little bit more for Krishna. Not being complacent, getting out of my comfort. Krishna, he'll reciprocate at the end. In such a wonderful way, that you'll be like, oh my God, I didn't deserve this. I did a little time for Krishna, giving me so much. And then you want to do more for him. And in this way, over a course of a lifetime, our faith increases. Until one day we're able to really understand the meaning of what faith is. That actually, if I have faith in Krishna, everything will be taken care of. If I make Krishna my life and soul, everything will be taken care of. And just like the gopis of Vrindavan. If we please Krishna, our home, our family, our society, everyone will be fine. Everyone will be taken care of. We can get there. We can get there. We have to get there. There's no choice. This is where we're going, right? But in gradual steps. Right now we may think of it, and just the idea itself may cause more stress. So no, that's not it. We do it little by little. Let's try to do a little bit more for Krishna. And see how Krishna is doing it. And to develop such a personal relationship with Krishna. So close. To see that actually Krishna is working like this in my life, that we naturally want to do more. It's a very natural, very organic, a very loving process, not a mechanical one. No one standing there with a whip and saying, do more, do more. It happens naturally as a product of the relationship. Anything else? More questions?
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Vijay, if you want to ask a particular conversation game, if you want to achieve, if you want to make any kind of particular decision in your life, you should move down the line. Okay, that's from the heart to the head to the hand. Okay, you can elaborate a little bit with the example as possible.
Right. Okay, so, suppose I'm trying to make a choice about what career to choose, what career path to go on. So the first question I ask is, okay, what do I want to accomplish by it? What is my purpose in going through this career? This is a question, for example, several years ago, I was asking this question. What do I want to do? And if we ask, well, what is my motivation behind it? What's my purpose? Is it money? Is it family? Is it God? What is it? And it may be a combination of all three. So then, try to figure out what is the most important. What matters the most. Okay, ultimately, as a result of this, I want to serve Krishna. Because in the end, that's what matters most. And if I please Krishna, then everyone else will be pleased automatically. Right? Okay, so I have some faith here. I have this much knowledge I have. This is where I know my motivation should be. Then we say, what is the best way to accomplish that? What can I choose in such a way that all these things can be fulfilled? I can get a decent career for maintaining a family, and at the same time I can pursue what is my ultimate goal, serving Krishna. Okay, so now this eliminates this, this eliminates this, this eliminates this. Okay, now I've got a few choices, maybe two or three. First, that will be maybe have 10 to 15 choices. Now we thought, okay, maybe 5 or 6 questions. Then the last question we ask is, okay, how do I do? What is actually attractive? In my situation, I can't do this. Why? Okay, I don't have, this is not my nature. I don't have the mark to do so. Or, this is too far away. I don't have to move too far. Whatever it might be. I don't have the financial need. So some things, okay, these are eliminated here. And in this way, we come to a few decisions. Now, here's the thing, here's the issue that's arising. How do we know that what our heart is telling us is right? How do we know that what our mind is telling us is right? They could be misleading us, right? Our heart could be in the wrong place. And this is the real problem. When the hands get out of hand, and the hands, they go overboard, the problem is they become greedy. When the head goes out of whack, then it becomes arrogant, it becomes proud. And when the heart is in the wrong place, then we become selfish and envious of others. And so therefore, Krishna's message, the whole process of Krishna consciousness, is meant to purify these three things, the heart, the mind, and the hand. We have to not only hold these things in balance, but we have to get them in the right order. We have to purify it. Because just holding them in balance is not the, in itself, you know. They had everything figured out. A very well-balanced individual. They had their goals straight, they had their motivations clear, right? They knew what to do exactly, and they were materially speaking very successful. But that's not very important. And the problem is, these three things have to be purified as well. They have to be cleaned up. And this is the whole process of yoga. Like yoga is the process of purification of the mind, the heart, and the body. This is the whole process of what yoga is all about. This is the process of Krishna consciousness through chanting of the holy name, chanting of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. We can purify what's there in the heart. Shinvatam Pukatha Krishna, Punya Shavana Kirtana, Vidyantasa Yavadnari, Vidunoti Savitsa. Krishna is firstly residing in the heart of the honest and sincere devotee who goes to Krishna and says, "Lo Krishna, I know that this is what will really make me happy, serving you. But you know what? I don't have the strength to do it. I still have all these material desires, all these problems." For such an honest and sincere devotee, it says Krishna is firstly there in the heart, Vidyantasa, and Vibhunoti. He's cleaning the heart of the devotee, and he's purifying. So that's the important thing to watch out for. In practice, when we do this, yes, we should work from the top down. But at each step, we should ask ourselves, am I sure? Right? is my heart pure? Is my mind pure? Is my intellect, is it being purified enough? And this is why we have to take shelter in the Holy Name. Because the Holy Name provides us with that purity. We may not be pure all the time, but as long as we're in the shelter of the Holy Name, as long as we're in the association of the Holy, as long as we're under the guidance of the spiritual master, then we can be fairly certain that things will go right. That our heart and mind and comfort will be in the right place. There's so many things that could be said about this in terms of the guidance we receive from the spiritual master, how he helps us and so forth. But the agents of time will be that.
We don't know the whole picture.
where God receives his time. That's one thing. The other thing is that also it may appear to us that one person is suffering more than the other. But in the actual fact of the matter, everyone's state of suffering is as full as anyone. Right? Bhagavan says we each get a full state of happiness, we each get a full state of suffering. And sometimes it may appear to us from our position that this person's state of suffering is empty and the state of happiness is full. And my state of suffering is full and happiness is empty. But I can guarantee you that's not the way. That's not the nature of the world. Krishna says, Dukhale Vashasana. This material world is a temporary place. It's a place of suffering. And the only reason we're here is because we each have to eat that full place of suffering. We have to. But we can eat it because it's being forced down our throat, or we can eat it because it's coming from the loving hand of the world. That's the only difference. But the place is going to be full either way. No one has it easy.
No. What's the way to moksha?
The way to liberation, the way to moksha. Moksha can be achieved, actually it's not for Buddhism. Any one of these processes of karma, of jnana, of bhakti can lead us to moksha. Basically, moksha is a process of detachment from the world. Moksha means liberation or freedom. If we detach ourselves from this world, and we become free. We become liberated. The sufferings of this world don't affect us. But in fact, moksha is not all that we're after. Detachment is not enough. After we become detached, after vairagya, then what next? Then we need attachment to Krishna. And therefore, for a devotee, moksha is actually not something that's very, very important. Krishna will give moksha to Sakya. He'll hand it out. It's very cheap for him. For him, it's no big deal. But bhakti or prema, that's something that's very, very, very important. Because that involves the Lord selling himself to the devotee, giving himself. So, that's a very large question, of course, in so much detail, but just in brief. Thank you all very much for your attention. I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful being here. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Appeal to their intelligence. And one of the nicest ways to do this, the most effective way, is to encourage them to study the chapter, to study Srila Prabhupada's book. It may seem like this is taking away further time from their academic study. But in fact, what it does is it helps us focus, because this point we've been discussing of putting our priorities in the right place, it helps us do that process. So the more you can encourage this child to stay in association with devotees and to study especially Srila Prabhupada's book, because at this age, things are difficult to be taken on faith. At certain ages you can say, the mother said something, you do it on the page. Or we get older than we realize the importance of faith. But at a certain age, you need to figure everything out about faith. Faith is not sufficient. And so that's when it's very important to feed the mind, to feed the intelligence. And there's nothing, no better way to do it than to know about the goal. They're so logical in nature, so coherent. If we have a process where we can sit down with the child, or have someone else sit down, someone he has a good relationship with, and study these books, discuss them in a way that's lively, that's interesting, that's interactive, then it can really, it can help settle the mind and the emotion. Because the hormones are going very strong at that age, the mind is going wild at that age, and it can really act as a settling factor. My mother, in her home school, she has a whole kind of process that she suggests for discussing with children studying the Bhagavatam, especially in ways that will be interesting to them that will hold their attention. But the results are made, they're phenomenal. They're really powerful. So that's one suggestion. So ultimately, you see, Krishna consciousness is the solution that is. It's a fact. Sometimes it sounds a little fanatical, sounds a little one-sided, impractical, but it's the truth. It's a fact. And we just have to find the right way to go about it, just the right application. What aspect of Krishna consciousness should be used at this time? What aspect should be applied at this time? That's all. That's the only thing. Sometimes this is more useful, sometimes it is more useful. Sometimes you can capture someone's heart through kirtan. Other times you have to capture their heart through study. Other times you have to capture them through prasad. Whatever works. Right? Whatever works. If somehow you can get the Krishna consciousness to become more serious for you, then automatically the other problems will be.